Hello and welcome to the AI Future Show with me, your host and guide, Professor Andy Pardo. Today's episode is a recording from our very first live show with two fantastic guests, Stuart Sherman and Barry Singleton from Scaled Insights. Barry, do you want to kick off and introduce yourself?
Sure, I'll do a quick one. So I'm Barry Singleton. I'm the Chief Relationship Officer for Scaled Insights, and ordinarily we're located at the Nexus building, which is on the campus of University of Leeds. At the moment, I'm about 3 miles down the road in the Costa del Rounde, as we like to know it now during this beautiful weather. And really my primary role for the company is to identify and develop and nurture relationships towards doing both academic and commercial applications for our technology.
Brilliant. Okay, Stuart?
So I'm Stuart Sherman, and I'm the CEO and I guess the original idea mind behind Scaled Insights. And maybe I'll use the opportunity to talk a little bit about what Scaled Insights is, which is the real thought is that one of the challenges that I see overall, and this is what gave birth to Scaled Insights, is that we're very busy analyzing humans using artificial intelligence and big data and all of that stuff. But what we're kind of doing, a lot of what we're doing is really like rowing a boat where you're going forward, but you're facing backwards. So a lot of what we do is using historical data to analyze humans. So being an industrial psychologist, I was a little frustrated, and somebody who's been involved in technology since 1989. I've a little frustrated by that because I've been involved in technology and big data literally since the early 90s. And I felt that there's always something missing, which is the humanity. And so what we did is we started looking at systems and processes that existed in the offline world that help humans understand what other humans are like. So the best basic example would be a Rorschach test, where I show you a picture and you tell me it looks like the angel of death or it looks like a beautiful butterfly. And your answer tells me a lot about who you are and how you see the world. So as humans, we do this inherently, and you experience this literally if you went in for psychoanalysis or anything like that, where they're not necessarily listening to what you say, but how you say it. And you're doing that with me right now. I'm talking and you're building an impression of who I am as a person. And then what we tend to do as humans is, oh, I remind you of your friend Ralph. And so now you've built a predictive model of how I will behave because you know how Ralph behaves because you know him a lot more intimately than you know me. So my question was, could we use AI to actually do something quite similar? Could we analyze human speech and start understanding personality behind it? And starting literally in the late 50s, there was work that was done around this. That's all around neuro-linguistic pattern analysis. So what they're doing is they're looking at the patterns, because when you speak out of your subconscious. You're not really thinking, you're just flowing language. And so we often, like probably anybody who's ever had a mother, which I think is everybody, has been in a situation where you've been told in Canada it would be the garbage or the trash, and in UK it would be the rubbish, where your mother says, "Will you please take out the rubbish?" And you say, "I guess so." And then you're wondering why your mother, or it could be your spouse, is upset with you. Because "I guess so" is actually leaking an emotion that's behind, or a concept that's behind the words. "I guess so" really doesn't say, "I'm really excited to do this." It's actually saying, "Yeah, if you're going to make me." And when you think about it in that context, our thought was, could we analyze language and then start putting people into categories and understanding their behaviors so that you can actually link that with big data? So ultimately, what we need to do is we need to reduce a human personality down into a numerical score so that it can be number crunched along with the other big data. Because if you said, "I'm a Ralph," and you've got 12 other Ralphs, that's really difficult to plot. You know, what's the graph for that? But if you say I'm a number 17 and that represents this dot here on the graph, you can then understand that, and then you can start comparing that with other big data. And to me, that's the opportunity where we start bringing humanity into the data. When people talk about the risks of AI, one of the challenges is that we go back to like Terminator, you know, where the computers decide that humans are too dangerous and they should just wipe them out. Well, arguably, if you're going to use AI to study global warming, and the AI was really good, it would say get rid of humans because humans cause global warming, you know. We're the root cause when you think about it. We burn fossil fuels. If you said, oh, it's cows and the cow farts and burps, well, it's because humans eat the cows that we have so many cows. So at the end of the day, you do that. So what we have to do is we have to put the humanity back into it and say, how do we analyze the problem from a human standpoint? So the solution for global warming isn't to get rid of humans, because we would find that unacceptable, but maybe it is to change people's perceptions and behaviors so that we act more responsibly. So maybe we should be eating less cows, or maybe we should be raising cows differently, or maybe we should be 3D printing meat, or like all of these different possibilities come out as we think about it alongside the human condition. Because I'll tell you something, I'm a carnivore. And if you told me I couldn't eat meat, I don't know if I want to live. So I need my barbecue. So, you're not going to shift me. What you're going to do is you're going to nudge me. And this is where we believe our technology really comes into its best.
That's really interesting. And how do you... So that sort of whole area of behavioral change and nudging is quite a new area. And I know you guys have been looking at this for quite some time. What's your take on doing this type of analytics, especially in the current environment with privacy and the ethics that seems to be very much on the radar at the moment? Are you getting any resistance, and how are you dealing with those types of issues?
I wouldn't say resistance. And the big thing is that we actually don't need to know who you are. It's actually quite unimportant for us. Like, we don't need to know it's you know, Professor Andy Pardo. What we need to know is that there's a cluster of people who are like Andy, who think about things in a certain way. So maybe one of the things we could talk about is we just did a large scale COVID study in the UK. And we were looking at, we basically did a survey asking for some natural language, which is what we process. So we need 300 to 500 words of natural language. And then we asked you some questions. And the questions really became the big data that went behind it. And what we were looking at was your personality versus your behavioral and risk attitude. And the thought really was, could we determine that people with certain personalities have certain risk profiles that they find comfortable? And then if you could determine that, then you could actually look at it and say, okay, how would you talk to this cluster of people so that you would impact them? Because typically what we do is we have a one-size-fits-all approach towards everything in our world. And the one-size-fits-all approach is not, like, yes, it's effective, but it's not incredibly effective. And examples would be how many of us right now have a Coke in our hand? Yet Coca-Cola spends billions of dollars every year advertising Coke, trying to get us to nudge towards Coke. They do enormous amounts of market research. They do everything they possibly can. And yet, if you talk to Coke right now, they would say that they're trying to get more into personal marketing and figuring out how to get affinity markets going. And they're focused on trying to make that message much more relevant to you specifically. And when you look at it in that context, that's exactly what our technology does. But we don't need to know who you are. We just need to know which cluster you fall into. So I fall into the middle-aged redhead man cluster, for example. So if you want to get me to drink Coke, you might have to activate me with some message like, you know, the caffeine will give me more energy to write reports or something. Sure. Whereas someone else may be motivated by something totally different.
And this is interesting because obviously it's trying to refine the actions from predictive models based on your personality type and the type of behaviors that you would, based on your personality, you would normally exhibit. Do you think in the future that there's a way that this will extend to the point where it might become a very personalized profiling and it would take in more real-time context about me? Because, you know, having a personality type is one thing, but, you know, whether, you know, the sort of context of what's going on around me at the time might also affect my decision making. Do you see that coming in the future as well?
Yes, very much so. I see a future. So we already have this happening. And so whenever I talk to people and they have a, oh my God, kind of reaction, I always say, well, hold on a second. Do you read your news online? Are you using Google News or Apple News or Flipboard or one of those products? Well, it's already shaping your news. If you're a conservative, and we're seeing this more and more, we saw this in Brexit, we've seen this in the rise of Trumpism in the US, where people are only receiving news within their bubble. And so we're already using technology to do that. The problem is that the technology is essentially dumb. It's making its best guess based on what other people do, but it's not actually looking at me as a person and saying, how do I behave? How do I see the world around me? How would I react? So right now, there's some great examples like the Black Lives Matter movement, which has resonated literally around the world, where we're seeing people who are actually theoretical Trump supporters and very conservative are changing their point of view in light of Black Lives Matter, because I'm not sure if the word is humanitarian, but they have a much more social outlook. It's just they're politically conservative, and now those two things are at a crossroads, and they're actually being forced to make a choice. And I think that as we can start understanding people better, we can start communicating with them for the better if we do it right. So we're looking at things like, how do we get you to take your drugs? So an example in the UK, if you're male and over 50 and you've been diagnosed with high cholesterol and high blood pressure, you'll be put on cholesterol drugs, a statin, and some sort of beta blocker, or ACE inhibitor or something that is a blood pressure lowering drug. Sure. The chances of you taking the drug after 90 days are actually 50-50, believe it or not. If you thought about it in the terms of the NHS, the National Healthcare System, which pays for your open heart surgery and your diabetes and all the other health problems and strokes and things that go along with not managing these things, it's so much more expensive for you not to take those pills. So the question is, how do we get you to take those pills? Well, your reasons to take the pills are different than my reasons to take the pills. Mm. And so if we could understand each other better and understand what's going on and how we see the world, we could then shape the message. So I like the analogy of, we have a 30-year-old Donald Trump and a 30-year-old Mahatma Gandhi. And let's assume that they each have a 2-year-old daughter. So you've got a 2-year-old Indira and a 2-year-old Ivanka. What would you say to Mahatma Gandhi to get him to take his drugs versus what would you say to Donald Trump? And for Mahatma Gandhi, I would argue that it was his worldview was more outside of his own person. So based on this outside of his own person thinking, you might say to him, because he's 30 and thinks he's invincible, you might say, look, you need to take care of yourself now. Imagine how devastating it would be for Indira if you weren't able to walk her down the aisle when you're in your 50s. And yet for Donald Trump, he's more about himself. And there's a great clip going around now of Donald Trump of Ivanka describing Donald as being more about himself. So I think we could all acknowledge it. And you would say to him, you need to take care of yourself. Imagine how horrible it would be for you if you couldn't walk Ivanka down the aisle. So it's the exact same message, but with a nuance. And the technology's availability is there. So we could analyze this. The question is, do we actually have the AI to do it? And that's why we built what we built, so that we could actually start understanding these nudges and then helping people. So I imagine one day your smartwatch will notice you walking into McDonald's and saying, you know what, maybe you should be making a healthier choice today. But it'll say it in a way that will actually resonate with you. So instead of saying, maybe you should be making a healthier choice, it might say, hey, you're going to Tenerife. You better look good in that that Speedo, Andy. Or for somebody else, it could say, you know, you're getting married next month and you want to fit into the wedding dress. So these things and how we say it would vary based on who we are, where we are, and what
it sounds like. It's not just about behaviors and personalities. It's about motivations and potentially yes. emotions as well. So it sounds like you're trying to encapsulate all of those elements into your analytics, essentially.
I think it's interesting, yeah. Andy, because going back to the work we've been doing around the COVID survey, during the results and the data that we got from that, we were able to identify two very clearly distinct clusters around people's attitudes towards lockdown, social distancing, homeschooling, you know, lifestyle, well-being. So there were two very clearly discernible clusters that we could find from that data. One, which was much more positive in their sentiment, the more trusting of public health messaging, and they were more happy and dutiful in terms of respecting guidelines. The second cluster that we were able to identify were much more negative, more neurotic, more insecure. And actually, that's given us some really interesting insights. And the idea is that we could then feed that into public health, whether it's local government, whether it's, I don't know who it might be, you know, Public Health England, and really kind of give them that understanding that there isn't just the one size fits all doesn't work. Like Stu mentioned, you know, you think about problem gambling. There's this whole environment about trying to prevent problem gambling, but you're bombarded with adverts to encourage you to gamble. So it's just the data really gave us some really interesting insights into people's.
And I think that's really interesting to highlight, right? So you've identified two main sort of clusters of sort of behavior or attitude, if you like, to COVID and the approach with it. But I'm assuming within those two clusters, there are multiple personality types that potentially the messaging to them to reinforce what the National Health Service wants us to all do, which is to stay indoors and, you know, keep safe, and et cetera, et cetera. The messaging could be tailored for the different personalities within those two clusters, essentially. Is that, that's kind of, absolutely. I guess, what we're, yes. what you're trying to get to, right?
Yes. And not only that, but also trying to use data to properly understand humans. Because one of the challenges that we have is that we make assumptions about people's behaviors. And these assumptions are not based on maths. They're based on really stereotypes. And it's very dangerous. And we see it. We're starting to see it more as we look at what's happening in the world today, where we're challenging more and more stereotypes. But I like the analogy of, you know, when you're driving on the highway or motorway, I guess, in England, and someone passes you, they're a madman. And if somebody's holding you up and not driving fast enough, they're an idiot. Yeah. And yet one of these people is more conservative and one of these people is more aggressive. And you're making judgments on them based on their observed behavior. What you haven't read into it, though, is why they have this behavior. And for all you know, the madman might be in a hurry because their wife is about to give birth, or they're maybe about to lose their job and they've been held up behind one of these slow people, or all of these different things. And so as we start to understand each other and back up our behaviors with maths and start saying, okay, you're part of a cluster. We understand who you are and how you think, and we can prove this out. We can start looking at people a lot more compassionately, because the challenge right now is that we look at people and we'll go, oh, well, he's a Brexiteer, or she's a Ramoner, or whatever it is. And based on these assumptions, we then broad brush everybody. And what we're proving out as we do this analysis is that there's subclusters. And as you start looking at subclusters, like I fall into the cluster of men over 50. But if you look at men over 50, there's men over 50 who, you know, jump out of airplanes, and there's men over 50 who, you know, knit and stay home and, you know, worry about stuff. So you by calling me a man over 50, you haven't really said enough about me.
No. And this is what I'm thinking about. Ultimately, we're all a cluster of one, right? I mean, yes. Ultimately, you know, we each have our own context that is actually is a factor in our personality, our motivations and emotions. And I guess in some ways this relates to the whole data bias sort of concerns that, you know, it's very difficult to treat people in those large clusters, because if I just make assumptions about you, Stuart, because you're in the over 50 cluster, I may get it right, but there's a good chance I may also get it wrong as well. And I think this is, you know, there's lots of conversations going on at the moment, especially around the whole facial recognition and the ethics around that, but also the data bias issues. And I think, you know, actually the data will always have inherent bias in it to a degree. It's how we build the AI systems to deal with that, I think, is quite an interesting one.
I agree. And I think that we start taking bias out of it when we start looking at personality and stop looking at the tombstone data that is just so often found in our world. So I may have the same attitude as a woman in her 40s for some things. And there's no reason to make an assumption that because I'm male, I have certain attitudes or behaviors, or because I'm white, I have certain attitudes or behaviors. So really, I think that one of the challenges that exists right now is that we as a society are very fast to stereotype people into categories and then start saying, oh, this is who you are. So when we talk about data bias, I always look at it and say human bias. I was at a conference. I was one of the speakers at a conference of lawyers in Canada, one of the largest ones, who were talking about AI and ethics. And they were talking about the problem, you know, with insurance underwriting using AI. And they said, you know, it could have biases. It could be the blah, 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 blah. And my comment was, okay, maybe it does, but those biases are systematic. So it's uniformly applying those biases across everybody. And as a result, you can find them, identify them, and change the system. And if you change the system, you change it for everybody. I asked the question, who has looked at insurance adjusters? There's probably hundreds that work for every insurance company, and done a survey to find out what their implicit biases are.
I totally agree, right? And that's the thing, we've all got our own biases that are just sort of there subconsciously because of the environment we've lived in, the people that we've met, the interactions that we've had. So, and I think this is one of the challenges for AI, is that we kind of accept human-based decision biases, but we just don't seem to want to accept the same thing in our AI system. So I think this, as an industry, this is a challenge for us all to both educate people, our users and our clients, that, you know, these biases are there. It's how do we manage to minimize the impact, and what can we do either from using a sort of more behavioral approach to the data analytics to get a much finer grained viewpoint of individuals, and I think that's obviously going to help us going forward with this. But, you know, are there other more architectural and systematic things that we can do with the approach? And I think all of those things will come into play over time.
You said it before, Andy, you know, you mentioned that framing of AI and, you know, it's Skynet, it's Terminator, or it's going to solve all the world's problems. And things aren't as binary as that. Everything's on a scale and it's more fluid. You know, gender is not just one and the other. Race isn't just one and the other. It's there's so much nuance in between all those different positions, aren't there? And I think that's the same with the ethics of AI, that you know, ethically speaking, is it ethical to have some kind of system that helps someone stop them from smoking or stops them from gambling? It supports them in some kind of way or supports them with their mental health and well-being, whatever it might be. I would say yes. Is it ethical to force somebody down a particular path to make a certain choice? Then probably.
Yeah. And it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because if the individual is signed up to have that behavioural change and that nudge to help them give up smoking or, you know, lower their cholesterol or whatever the action is that they want to do, then I guess that's fine. But it's obviously, with all of these technologies, they can be applied for good and bad. So it's the, you know, the subversive sort of behavioural change that people aren't sort of aware of, I guess, is the issue. In terms of the sort of just going a bit further into the data bias, do you believe there are methods to actually measure the data bias that an algorithm exhibits? Is there a way to measure that, do you believe?
I think that there are a number. I think it really varies based on how you would approach it and what data you're analyzing. So, you know, for example, if you had a standardized set of people, and let's say 50% of them were men and 50% of them were women, and you ran them through the AI and you realized that it only had selected men, it would be very obvious about the gender bias. So I think that a certain amount of it is this is a question. Maybe I could describe this best with a Netflix example. So Netflix came out with, like, when you go to Netflix, you see the cover art for all of the movies. And what you don't know is that Netflix actually selects certain of that imagery. As a matter of fact, I believe they're doing it less now because they've had so many problems with it. But they were doing a lot of it before. And they were selecting that cover art based on your viewing history and your proclivities. So the challenge was that this was built in Silicon Valley by a bunch of probably white and Asian AI engineers who took a data set and did intense machine learning and then tested it out, probably on themselves. And what they didn't realize is that there are subsections of movie culture that are natural. They exist. It's not racially one way or another way. But for example, there's a lot of movies that have full black casts and black actors and black stars, just staying on our Black Lives Matter example. And if you're black, those movies probably resonate with you, just like movies that star Ed Sheeran probably resonate with me. And we like to see people who look like us in the movies. That's why I watch Brad Pitt movies. What was happening was that the people who watched a lot of black movies, black themed movies, were getting examples. And my favorite example of this was Good Will Hunting, which is a movie a lot of people have seen. There's a black janitor in it. He's got like a minute of screen time, maybe 2 minutes of screen time, and probably about 10 lines. But if you watched a lot of black themed movies, you actually got him as the keyframe of the movie. And the problem was not that the algorithm wasn't working correctly, because the algorithm basically said, show the person what they like to see the most. And if you watch a whole bunch of black themed movies, then that means you like black actors. So it goes through a movie that's what, a 90 minutes long plus, and it finds you the one black actor in it and it shows it to you. Yeah. It's done a perfect job. But it's done a crappy job from a human standpoint. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it was considered to be, there was whole tweets going on and stuff, this was about almost 2 years ago now, that Netflix was racist and blah, blah, blah. It wasn't that Netflix was racist. It was that they unleashed an algorithm into the world without fully testing it.
And it's not necessarily that the algorithm was wrong, right? It's the controls around it. So they should have, for example, with that example, they should have done some sort of measure of how long is the black actor in the movie, right? If they'd have done that, they'd have realized, oh, it's only 2% of the movie, so we can't use that, right? So it's almost the control framework around the algorithms that needs to be added in, right?
Well, Amazon have me in the males that like colourful leggings cluster after buying two pairs for a fancy dress. You know, they literally have based their profiling of me in that recommendation algorithm on my past actions of buying two pairs of leggings within the space of a couple of weeks because more than wasn't going to be delivered in time. So now I get lots of invitations to buy very colourful leggings.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
They don't realize that you're you're the world's largest Tinkerbell. I think for people who can't tell, how tall are you, Barry?
2 meters tall, so medically a giant is the, you know, that's the fact.
Awesome. So guys, what kind of things are you getting asked for from your clients in terms of the scalability of AI in terms of the ethics and the sort of the data bias issues? Are you getting a lot of conversations around those? Do your clients really care about those kind of aspects?
Well, actually, our clients our typical client recognizes that their existing data has a lot of bias in it. And typically, our clients recognize that they don't have the data to solve the problem that they think they have. Mm. So, examples, we're working on a project for Health Education England. We're actually into our third phase of it, where Health Education England, their responsibility is to educate healthcare professionals across England. That could be an occupational therapist, it could be a doctor, it could be a nurse, it could be a surgeon, like any type of medical professional. And the challenge is that all of them require continuing medical education. So that's a given. The problem is that the Health Education in England can only produce a certain amount of that continuing medical education. And there's certain stuff that they would really like everybody to read. But how do you make it interesting? So we've been looking at personalities and trying to say, what would be the best fit methodology? Like, what is the presentation of this information? How do you write the article? How do you format the article? Are there call-outs? Do you put statistics? Do you have a photograph of people's faces? What are all the different things necessary? What's the bait that gets the person to actually read the text? And if you think about it, if you read the Huffington Post or the Telegraph or the whatever it is, the Weekly World News, there's something that got you to read it, the way the headline was written, all of this stuff. So it's a question of using our technology to break people into clusters and then do sampling against those clusters to say what works, and then to say what's the one methodology that would be the most effective against the largest variety of these clusters. And in this case, I actually have a thing here that has some maths on it, but we're basically over, into the high 70, low 80s percent ability to satisfy everybody, which is huge. The challenge was that they actually had biases going in, like, oh, nurses only want to read this, and doctors only want to read that, and people in the north view it this way, and people in the south, you know, or in a hurry, and all these different biases. And what we've been able to prove out was that you could throw all that away because people are actually evenly distributed amongst personality types. And those personality types, although they do have some clustering based on geography, It's really unfair to say all Yorkshiremen are tight with money, or everybody from Newcastle drinks a lot, or whatever those things could be, because they're not fair. Because the second you say it, you've now dismissed a certain percentage. So by getting into the, let's say, 80% predictability range, we've only dismissed 20% of the population, which is a lot better than most models, which actually are, you know, 50-50 at best.
Mm. Okay. And what are your thoughts on trying to improve that even further? Have you got some thinking around that yet? Or
yes. We believe that we should be able to predict it better. The challenge is we have to do a lot more in order to do that. My belief is that what we're going to slowly find over time, and this is, it's a journey, it's not a destination, that humans actually have a lot in common with dogs, in the sense that we have, if you looked at it in terms of dogs, what you would find is that there's herding breeds. So if you had a herding breed, that could be an Old English sheepdog. It could be an Australian Shepherd, a German Shepherd. Believe it or not, Rottweilers were bred to be herding dogs. Although we think of them as protection dogs, they're actually herding dogs. And so if you think about it, these dogs all look quite different. And they have some differences in behavior. But if you breed two border collies, you get a herding dog at the end. And if your dog has a bit of border collie in them, then you get certain border collie behaviors. So my belief is that what we're going to be able to do, for starts, we know that humans tend to, like, we date and marry and reproduce with people who we have things in common with. Even though people say opposites attract, typically couples that are successful have similar values. They see the world in a similar way. It's very unusual that you would have a couple that would strongly disagree on a political party, or strongly disagree on an approach towards child rearing, or things like that. So by that very nature, we as humans fall into categories. I think that as we get more data, we'll be able to understand humans better as categories. And the important thing here is that this is not eugenics. A Rottweiler is black, an Old English sheepdog is white. There's nothing that you would look at externally that would indicate that those two dogs are one or the other. Like, they're totally different. And so as you look at it this way, my hope is that our intense use of our technology will start changing people's opinions and biases that they have inherently themselves towards each other. Like, people will look at me and say, oh, he's a redhead, he must have a fiery temper. Well, I don't. And why would I? Other than the fact that I have a certain hair color. So as we start doing this and breaking us down, I may fall into the, I don't know, terrier category or something like that. And so I have a very terrier-like behavior, or whatever these categories are. As we start to do this, we'll be able to understand and predict people's behaviors a lot better, and also understand how they want to interact with the world around them. You know, if you have a certain type of dog, some dogs are very, like, you can't take them for a walk because they just smell all the time and they need to smell and mark and whatever, they're unwalkable. And other dogs just need a run. And as we can understand us as humans this way, we can start to personalize information towards ourselves. We can start to understand ourselves better. And we'll actually be able to build computer systems that will predict and forecast human behaviors better, which I think will come down into our next phase of evolution of AI, where we're going to ask AI to make decisions on behalf of humans. Mm. And when it does that, it better understand those humans, or we're in trouble.
And I think this, again, goes back to the personalization of AI. So I think you'll have different layers of this that will ultimately have an Andy Pardo model, or a Barry Singleton model that has that nuances that are particular to me, but that's one layer of this sort of hierarchy of behavioral sort of and motivational and emotional kind of needs, as it were. Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, very much so. And so I would imagine that what there are is that there's layers within layers. So it might say, okay, Andy Pardo, you have a retriever personality. And so that's our big bucket for you. And then we can get into the smaller bucket of you're a retriever, but you're a conservative retriever, and you're a happy, positive, conservative retriever. And as we can start to split it more finely, we can understand what you want to know and see and understand, which suddenly takes us away from a world of, I'm a Canadian, but I look at Fox News as kind of they're feeding their base the information that they assume their base wants to hear. And to me, that's almost an insult to these people, because it's assuming that they're incurious. Mm. And in fact, there are lots of people, and I have friends who are conservatives and Trump supporters and Fox News watchers, and they are very curious people. But what's happened is that they have been looked at the macro level. And so, therefore, all the information that they're given at the macro level causes them to not get down into the micro. Whereas if you gave them some more data and some more stuff, they would be able to think about the world differently on their own, for their own reasons.
Mm. Okay. And I know you guys have been doing a lot of work in the sort of med tech space, but do you work in other industries as well? Have you been?
Oh, yes. For example, we've just completed a project in banking with a very large with a large financial institution that does a lot of mortgage lending, and this hopefully will be near and dear to everybody's heart, because everybody gets spam with offers that they really aren't interested in. And so we built a predictive model. They were not able to predict if you were interested in a mortgage, if you would be interested in renewing your mortgage or not. They know when, like, they know a time window when most people renew their mortgages, but they don't know if you would want to and when in that time window you specifically are. So typically what happens is your bank realizes you've got X months to go on your mortgage, and you start getting spammed with mortgage renewals. And you're not interested. So we were actually able to build a model that was in the 70s on both predictive of would you be willing and interested in a mortgage renewal offer, and also in the 70s of would you really not want to receive a mortgage renewal offer. And when you start thinking about that, that's incredible efficiency, because your bank has a lot of things to talk to you about, and they can only choose one or two things before you hit delete. And when they pound you over the head with the same one or two things, you're in trouble. And yet they probably look at you and say, your mortgage is expiring in the next year, you're 52 years old, send them offers. And so when we start looking at this in this instance, it's very powerful. I think that an area that we very much want to expand into, we're doing some work in it now, and we'd like to do a lot more, is in the space of online retail, one of the biggest challenges that exists and will exist for the next at least 24 months and maybe longer, unfortunately, is the death of the small intermediary. So there used to be a shop down the street from you that sold knickknacks for your home, for example. They're stocked up with knickknacks that they couldn't sell. Their rent has been accruing. Nobody's been buying. They're probably bankrupt. And so you're going to automatically start buying your knickknacks from either directly from Knickknack Incorporated, who manufactures knickknacks for you, or from Amazon, where you can get knickknacks made by Knickknack Incorporated. The challenge is that Amazon has a model where if your knickknack is selling really well, Amazon will make the Amazon, Amazon Prime special knickknack, and the knickknack supplier will be out of business too, and everything we buy will be Amazon. There was a movie where all restaurants were Taco Bell, You know, it's horrible. We want choice. The challenge is that the knickknack supplier, because they've used intermediaries for so long, and so many companies have this, and clothing companies, it's the bane of my existence when I've been shopping online, because it's the only kind of shopping I've been doing, that they don't understand if I see a picture of the top and the pants and they match, and yet they're offering me the top and I choose to buy the top, then it shows me the next recommended products, and the next recommended products don't include the matching bottoms for some reason. And the opportunities are for the manufacturer, who is the retailer in this case, to get out of selling an online catalog and thinking about it in the terms of catalog, where they have tops and bottoms and socks and shoes, and start saying, oh, you bought the yoga top, you must want a yoga experience, which is what a salesperson would do for us. Would you like the yoga mat, the yoga candle, the yoga exercise bands, and the yoga pants?
And the leggings.
Totally agree. And I think, Barry's a prime example. And I think retail's in a real mess right now, right, because of the coronavirus and the fact that we've all been stuck indoors. But I think that was... that disruption to retail was kind of happening anyway, but it's just been accelerated. But I totally agree with you. The whole recommendation engines that Amazon and others are using have got some work to be done, right? So definitely needs a lot of improvement there. And maybe they'll figure that out at some point. We can hope so. We're coming close to the top of the hour. So I think I'm going to just wrap it up there, to be honest with you. So we've exhausted the questions that have come in as well, so that's great. Just a really big thank you to Stuart and to Barry for being our first sort of guests on the show. It's been a fantastic conversation, and as always, I really appreciate the chats that we've had over the years, and I'm sure that will continue going forward. And hope to have you back on the show, in a few months' time as well. So it'd be great to sort of see how things are progressing and how you're developing your behavioural models. And I love this sort of comparison to the dog breeds as well. So that for me was quite a sort of highlight of the show. So thank you for that. And thank you all for joining both on the Zoom call and on the live streaming, and fantastic session. And for those in the UK, at least, we'll still got a bit of time to enjoy the nice weather this evening. So thank you all, and have a good rest of your day. Thank you all for joining.
Okay. Pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
If you like this show, it would be great if you could follow and share on social media. All of our links are available on pardo.ai. Neurons.ai is an online platform and community for those interested in the field of artificial intelligence, both for experts and novices alike. It covers a wide range of topics from AI, machine learning, data science, and neuroscience. And it provides a number of different services and activities, including an online knowledge base and news feed, forums, member profiles, events, meetups, and even its own conference. Don't forget to check out awards.ai. It's the Oscars of the AI world, the largest global annual achievement awards for artificial intelligence, independently judged with over 60 categories. The 5th awards are still open for nominations until the 31st of July 2020. And best of all, it's free to enter. If you have an idea for a topic of discussion or would like to be a guest speaker on the show, please go to pardo.ai/show and fill in the suggestion survey. Thank you for listening to this episode of the AI Future Show. I hope you've enjoyed it and will take the time to rate it and to share with your friends, family, and colleagues. Also, don't forget to check out other episodes of the show. To find out more about me, visit pardo.ai. Are you an AI-related company and would like to sponsor one of the episodes or a full series of the AI Future Show? If so, please contact me on my website.